Good morning, friends, and welcome to Meet a Pioneer. Today is January 25th, 1985. I'm Gail Malloy. Each Friday morning at 9 o'clock, we meet a pioneer. We're going to spend the next hour with Mr. Henry Brockman. He was born April 2nd, 1896, and has been in the Fairbanks area for nearly 60 years. Our program this morning is sponsored by Larson's Jewelers, the Two Rivers Lodge, the Forget-Me-Not, Mount McKinley Mutual Savings Bank, Sophie Station, Interior Signs, Denali Chiropractic, and the Riverboat Discovery. This is Paul Rosenthal's Alaska Flag Song. In the studio with me at KFAR Radio this morning is Mr. Henry Brockman, and a pleasant good morning to you, Henry.
Good morning.
You sound healthy and vigor and robust. You're certainly a good-looking man.
Oh, thank you.
I understand one of the secrets to your success is bike riding.
Yes, I ride bikes, but indoors now, not outside on the road.
Well, you know, before we get into the history and some of the stories, I'd like to identify that part of your life, because I had some calls from people who said, the name rings a bell. Is he by any chance the nice fellow that used to ride up and down Tina Hot Springs Road? And I said, yes. Tell us, how many years have you been riding a bicycle?
Oh, my goodness. I started in when I was 12 years old. Riding bicycles.
Now, why did you ride up and down Chena Hot Springs Road all this time?
Exercise.
Just for fun.
Yeah.
And how many miles did you average?
Oh, I had about a 7 mile beat there that I used.
Now, when was the last time you did this?
Oh, goodness. Been about 3 years ago.
3 years ago it's been?
I got nicked just a little bit, like by one of them little fast cars, you know.
Wow.
And that told me to stay off of the highway.
And you were 85.
I was 85 then.
A young woman called me and said she used to bike ride with you, and she says she couldn't even keep up with you.
Oh, that was Mrs. McGee, I think, yeah. Yeah.
That's something. That's quite a story. Well, now that we've identified a little bit for some folks who you are, the fellow that's seen bike riding up and down Chena Hot Springs Road, let's find out where the story begins. 1896 is when you were born.
Well, there's an old fella told me about how rich you could get digging razorback clam in Cordova, and I was in Washington State at the time working for the state highway, and so there's where I got the idea coming to Alaska.
Now, you were born in Texas.
In Texas,
so you're
yeah.
Original Texas boy, uh-huh.
Yeah, I'm a southerner.
Now, how did you happen to leave Texas?
Oh, goodness. Uncle Sam needed me to make the world safe for democracy, you know. That was World War I. And I didn't get back to Texas for 11 years.
Well, after the war, what did you do in those years?
Oh, I took off for Arizona.
Arizona?
Went to work in the copper mines after the war.
What kind of work was that?
Well, that was hard work, drilling rock and breaking rock, and all underground, you know.
Huh.
It was quite dirty.
Do you remember, by any chance, what a man made doing that kind of work then?
They were paying the muckers, that's the fellow that shovels up the dirt the miner breaks. I think it was $5 a day, and the miner got $5.50.
Was that, that's pretty good then, wasn't it? Is that considered good
days.
Wages? Yeah.
It was 1920.
Okay, so what brought you to the, where you first heard about Alaska, clam digging?
Oh, that was in Washington State when I heard about that.
Uh-huh.
That was before I come to Alaska.
What was the story you'd heard about digging clams that sounded so intriguing?
Oh, get so, make so much money, get so rich. And I wanted to get rich, like everybody else in them days. And so I decided to go to Alaska. And this old-timer that talked me into it, he let me down, so I bought my ticket. Instead of Cordova, I bought it for Ketchikan, the first port. I talked to a few old-timers around Seattle that they told me there's a lot of work around any place in Alaska, so you don't have to go all the way to Cordova to get work. So you can find it in Ketchikan, and I did.
When did you get to Ketchikan? What year was that?
That was 1926.
1926. What was going on in Ketchikan then?
Oh, it was a busy place, fishing and all of that. That was in May when I got there, you know, and everything is, there's more work than you could imagine around there. So I never thought much about going to Cordova. I just went to work in Ketchikan, and it took me 4 years to finally get to the Cordova. And then I didn't go there to dig clam. I went there to work for the Copper River Northwestern Railroad.
Oh, my. Well, what did you do in Ketchikan those 4 years?
Well, I wasn't in Ketchikan most of the time. I was in Juneau. I only stuck around Ketchikan some, and I went to work. I got to Juneau, and I got to working on a pile driver there repairing the city docks. And so I decided I wanted to be a forester, so I went up to the Forest Service office, and there was a fellow in there, he told me right away, he says, I'm not representing the Forest Service, I'm representing Zeller Black Pulp and Paper. We're cruising timber up here. So says, you like the outdoors? You bet I do. He says, by golly, I can use you. So I went to work for this party, and I worked there 2 summers, and that was the best job I ever had in Alaska. Most enjoyable. It was just one big outing all the time. We lived on a boat, or a scow rather, and had a big boat to tow us around from anchorage to anchorage. And we'd work about 2 weeks running lines through the woods, you know, and looking at the timber. Then we'd move, and there's always different scenery. And in fact, we went clean around Prince of Wales Island. That's over 300 miles long. And part of Chichikov and Baranoff, and we even got up in the Glacier Bay district. We was anchored in a cove there they called Bartlett Cove, and that was the river that come out of the Glacier Bay country. And there was quite a pothole right at the end of the river, but then there was shallow bars. We could only get in there at high tide, you know. And so I explored around there quite a bit, and it is what they called Strawberry Point, right up to the left of where we were anchored. And there's nothing but sand dunes that the glacier had shoved out there, and there were wild strawberries growing every place. And these sand dunes, there was regular fox and owl dens all over the country.
Gee,
and they were up 200 or 300 feet high. And I remember getting up there and looking around, and I could see the glacier up north. That's Glacier Bay now. I could still see the ice, and I'd like to go there once more and take a look and see if that ice is still in sight.
Gosh. Well, that was a fun time. How did you live then? Did you camp out at night and as you traveled around?
No, we had a barge to live on, a 50-foot barge and a...
Oh, I see.
A 64-foot canary tender, a boat to tow us around. And we'd anchor, you know, any place that was good anchorage.
How
and work from there.
How did you happen to get out of that, leave that kind of work and lifestyle?
Well, that's lasted till 49, and then the stock slump, you know, the depression started.
Oh, and that affected that company outside.
Yeah,
so.
they almost went broke. I took a trip out to the States in 28 and spent the most of the winter in Seattle and Portland. And then I come back in the spring and saw my boss, and he says, well, there's nothing doing in this job anymore. I said, we just barely are hanging on. And so I come on up to Juneau, and I run into a fellow that I'd worked with right there in Juneau, and he'd been up on the Copper River and come Juneau that winter to work in the mine. And he told me, he says, I'm going back up in just a few days to Cordova. And says, two old-timers quit up there on the bridge crew, and I'm going to recommend you. And in about a week, I had a letter, come on up and go to work. So the depression didn't affect me at all. I worked all through that. That put me on the Copper River Railroad, but still I wasn't digging clam in Cordova.
Which was your dream, of course.
Which was my dream.
Well, that Copper River Railroad's pretty famous. Lots of interesting stories
about
that. I'd like to point out one thing, though, for our regular listeners to meet a pioneer. So when you were in Cordova, you knew a young man at the time who I recently interviewed on this program as a pioneer.
Yeah, what was that, Woody?
Yeah, sure, yeah.
Woody Johansson, yeah.
He was just a boy then, huh?
He was just a boy working for the telephone company for the railroad. Huh. That was his job.
Well, what did you do then for the railroad?
I was a bridgeman.
What's a bridgeman?
Wooden bridges. That's pile driver work.
You are? So the next time our listeners see those bridges, you're one of the fellows who made them? Those
well,
wooden
yes,
bridges?
Them wooden bridges, they're practically all gone now.
Oh,
I
see,
yeah. Yeah, because... they don't last long. But we had to jack up that big million-dollar bridge across the Copper River, you know.
Now, that one's still there.
Well, the earthquake shook one end of it down.
Okay, that's outside of Cordova. What, 30 miles or so?
About 30, yeah. Uh-huh. It's in the 30 miles.
Now, you worked on that bridge.
We had to jack it up because it had rollers, you know, for expansion and contraction. And it blowed so much sand in them rollers that they laid down and wouldn't straighten up. They were kind of oblong. They weren't round. And we had to jack that bridge up. And it took, they sent to Seattle and got hydraulic jacks with a 11-inch head. 200 ton is what they're supposed to lift. And we had four of them, and then the railroad company had a 100-ton jack, and them people in Seattle, some bridge building or moving outfit is what it was, told us just how much tonnage that took to lift that bridge, one end of it, just one corner. And it was 285 tons. That's what that weighed, and when them gauges registered that, the bridge come up.
Now why
they had it figured out just to the T.
Now, why did you have to lift the bridge? I don't understand.
It had rollers, you know, for expansion and contraction, you know.
Yes.
Iron, you know, expands and contracts, and them rollers would work like this, you know.
Uh-huh.
And it blew so much sand in there, so much wind up that river that the rollers stuck and they wouldn't straighten out, and it made it low on one side, the bridge, one corner.
Wow, what a feat.
And what a job. We worked 2 weeks to get that thing, the false work underneath. It was piling, you know, and there had to be good, heavy piling to set them jacks on.
Now, what was the purpose of this bridge being right there?
That was to get to the copper mines up at Kennecott.
The Kennecott copper mines, and it came into Cordova then to the shipyard.
Yeah,
there.
To the shipping point.
Now, I have seen that bridge, and that is quite a cavern and a river that it's built over. And if anybody's seen it, you've noticed the chunks of glacier ice coming down through it. How in the world in the 30s did that bridge get built there? I saw it, and I thought, goodness, it looked like quite an engineering feat.
Well, they build it on the ice. You know, that river freezes over there. It's not so far from Cordova either, but the ice got heavy enough that they could work on top of the ice, and they put in their footings through these old, what do they call them, sand hogs. They have put them under pressure, you know, and they put in their footings, their concrete footings that way, and then when the spring come, the ice took all the false work out, and there was the bridge.
Gosh.
It's quite a... And that's what they called a million-dollar bridge in them days, and that was built in 1911, I think. The date was still on the bridge, I remember. 1911, I think, on that big bridge.
And it cost $1 million then?
They called it the million-dollar bridge, which would be about $20 million now or more.
No kidding. Gosh. Well, how many years did you work on the Copper River Railroad?
3 seasons. It is about 7 months a season. Uh-huh. Start early in the spring, and we generally wind up in September.
Did you enjoy your work during that time?
Oh, we was riding around more than we were working. We'd have to go in the hole every time there's a train or something come along, and we'd have to go to a siding someplace. Well, if it's only a half an hour or so to go back to the job, we'd just stay in the siding. Oh, that was the biggest bunch of loafers I ever got with.
So you lived out of a camp then?
Yeah,
with
we had a bunch of fellas a bunch of cars we lived in. Railroad cars, and we bunk cars too, you know, and we had a cook car along, and had an engineer that pulled us around, and then the pile driver had its own engine too. That was known as X-52.
Mm-hmm.
And they finally brought that thing when the Copper River closed down. The Alaska Railroad bought that driver, and I see it working out here at Ladfield, driving a bridge. I went out there and looked at it. I'd worked on that thing
before. Oh, my gosh, huh. Now, we talked earlier, and you told me a story about the dangers of working across the river. Was this the same place? Was it the Copper River where the men...
Drowned it?
Yeah.
Well, that's the Copper River Bridge. They got a concrete bridge there now that the railroad company used to drive a bridge. You know, they'd just drive piling, and then in the spring, the ice would take the bridge out, and they'd drive it again.
Well, tell us the story about what happened to these men. Give us an idea of the kind of dangerous work it really was.
Well, it is really our job, the X-52, the lower bunch next to Cordova, to keep that bridge repaired. And we'd driven it that spring, but then it got to rain in the fall of the year, and the river got so high they had snow sheds, you know, where the snow slides were. They just built sheds so that the snow would slide over the track. And the river got so high, it washed the cribbing out on one of these snow sheds, and we was trying to catch that up. And the Chittenden Bridge went out at the same time, and there was another bridge out between us and Chittenden. We couldn't get there. We had to try to save that snow shed, and then it got to raining real hard, and the whole snow shed slid off in the river. And so then we had to drive a track just across, but the upper crew coming was trying to repair that bridge, and there was a lot of material on the east side of the bridge that was hanging on some piling, you know. It was just track is all it was. Well, they tried to go over there and save that material, and took an old waterlogged river boat and There was five of them went on there and tied a line to that, and then they was going to bring that line over and let the pile driver, take the pile runner and tie onto it. Then they was going to blast that material loose so it would swing off down the river off on the side where the driver was. Mm-hmm. And while they was over there trying to get that line across, there's a log or something caught the line and just turned the boat bottom side up, and there was five men in it, and every one of them drowned. Three of them never even come to the surface. Two of them did. And Jim Smalley, he was a strong swimmer, and there was a kind of a bar between a small stream and the main stream, and he swam enough so he got to this bar and stood there. He was only in waist-deep water. And by golly, he never made the little stream there to shore. He went down, and Big Eric Nelson, they saw him going around the bluffs down Chena, down the Chitna. It's about a half mile down there. He was still swimming, but they never found him. He drowned it too, and the other three never even came to the surface.
And had that upper crew not come down to do that, that was normally your job to be out of that
boat. That was our job.
We'll be back with Henry Brockman on Meet a Pioneer after this from our sponsors, Two Rivers Lodge, the Riverboat Discovery, and Forget Me Not. Meet a Pioneer is sponsored in part by the Forget Me Not gift shop. Sam and Jane McConkie believe beautiful things are timeless, and everything you find at the Forget Me Not shop is beautiful. Fine linens, silver, crystal, decorator items for your home or office, and that little something for special friends. Forget-me-not adds a feeling of luxury to even the most practical items. So, for beautiful things for years to come, for your friends, your home, or for yourself, remember the Forget-me-not gift shop, open 10 to 6, 6 days a week in Northgate Square. Alaska is still a land of pioneers, like the Binkley family, who for three generations have operated riverboats in the state of Alaska.
Running the Riverboat Discovery has given our family the opportunity to show so many others just a little corner of the Alaska we love. That's also one of the reasons we're proud to be a sponsor of Meet a Pioneer. This program gives us all a chance to find out more about the fascinating history of this special place we call Alaska, and we look forward to each week's program. We're looking forward to seeing you again next summer aboard the Riverboat Discovery.
Alaskans have always been famous for their hospitality, the same wonderful hospitality you still find at the Two Rivers Lodge, where Don and Stasha Troutman offer the best menu and interior, a comfortable, quiet atmosphere, and that famous Alaskan welcome to the people who are today's history makers. If you've been meaning to try one of the most talked about dining experiences in the Alaskan interior, don't wait any longer. Go out tonight to the Two Rivers Lodge, 16 Mile Chena Hot Springs Road.
We're back with KFAR's Meet a Pioneer in the studio with me this morning, if you're just tuning in, Henry Brockman. And we're at the point now where you're working for the Copper River Railroad and these five men are lost. Were those the only fatalities that you knew of during your time?
No. When we got the news that they drowned five men, Fred McMichael, Shorty, we called him. He was a little short guy. He says, well, that's 26 since construction days. That was 26 men that lost off of that bridge.
26?
Yeah. And that was in 1932, and they lost five then. And they lost one before. That made six that I knew of.
Well, how are these other men? What happened to the other 20 men?
Fall off of the bridge and drowned. That's all.
Most of them were all drowning then.
Yeah, every one.
That's a pretty wild river.
Wild is right. And they never picked up a body out of that river yet.
Gee whiz. Well, how did you feel about this? You find out all these men have died. You see these fellows go?
I'd worked for the railroad long enough. I rated half fare on any railroad, so They had just started, I think, about the second year they'd started this short course in mining here in Fairbanks.
Uh-huh.
The university or the college then days.
Right.
And I decided I'd go and take the short course in mining. But I'd made up my mind that I was through with the Copper River. And of course, when I went to the office and told them that I was going to go up here, take that short course, well, you'll be back with us. Oh, yeah, I'll be right back. It took just 31 years for me to get back to Cordova.
By the way, while you were in Cordova, did you ever dig those clams that you came
no.
up with?
No. I met a couple that... The husband was a crab fisherman, and he had crab pots, you know, out in the, oh, what did they call that, bay, and out of Cordova way there anyhow. But he and his wife, they'd dig their own clam when they wanted clam, but they didn't have really a clam boat. Them clam boats, you know, the tender that takes these diggers out, it's flat bottom, you know. It just sits on the mud flat any place, and then they take rowboats and go out on the beach where they can dig. Well, they didn't. Their boat wouldn't sit on the mud. It was too round the bottom, you know. So they had to stay out afloat, and we went ashore, but we couldn't find any clam. So I did make an attempt at it, but I never found any.
Gee whiz. By the way, speaking of food, what was the... Did you get good food? Were you fed well on the railroad?
Oh, goodness, yes. We ate well. There's no complaint there.
When we talked last time, too, you mentioned some story about a Swedish cook.
A Swedish cook?
Toby or somebody, Johnson?
Oh, he was a waiter. That was out of Ketchikan. That was my first job in Ketchikan. And waiting tables for a road building crew. They were building a road south of Ketchikan. And so I'd heard there was mining in Ketchikan, so I looked up this mining company and put in my application. They didn't have an opening, but they'd have for long, so I went on this hashing job. This little Swede working there, and he's just fresh from Sweden. He couldn't talk a word of English, but his folks sent him the funny papers in Sweden, the same as ours in English. And I was trying to teach him English from them funny papers. And that lasted 3 days, and here come a boat to pick me up. I had a job. And the little Swede cried, and his name was Tuli Janssen. And the timekeeper and his wife, they'd eat with the kitchen crew, and she called him Johnson. And no, he says Janssen. He wouldn't have Johnson at all, because they have no J in their language, you know.
So you're teaching him English to the funny papers.
And we tried, yeah. And, you know, I finally got back to Ketchikan, and I'd seen in some place in the papers where during World War II, he'd got a contract building some housing for the government. And, well, when I got back to Ketchikan, finally, I inquired about him. Oh, I said, he made well and went out to the States. He's rich now. And I'm still poor. Yeah.
Henry, there was another boy you knew in Cordova. A little kid named Warren.
Warren?
Taylor?
Yeah. I knew Mr. Warren Taylor, Sr. I remember he was a railroad engineer, and he took a correspondence course in law. And them old-timers around there, imagine a railroad engineer becoming a lawyer. Ha, 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 ha. But we all know what Warren Taylor Sr. did. That's history. And I guess the kid, Warren Jr., couldn't have been very old in them days. That was in 31 and 2. I remember I had a cabin in Juneau, and I put it up for sale, and I got a letter from a Swede, and his name was David Simonson, and he's a wonderful scribe, and his return address on the letter that he wrote me was David Simonson, you know, Alaska, the finest why you ever saw.
The return address.
Yeah, that was his address. And I sold the cabin to Simonson, and Warren Taylor made out the papers. And I went up to his office to have these papers made out, and he says, I've got to go to court. And he says, there's a stack of World War I papers. Says, look through them if you care. And he had a stack there about a foot and a half high, and I was busy there for 2 hours looking at these papers and reading about this great hero, Sergeant York. Well, he captured half of the Germans over there in France, you know, after the fighting was over. But I know how he did that, because he could talk German. He just took that old bullhorn and went out there and shouted, the war is over, boys, let's go home. And here they come in droves, and he got credit for capturing them. they come to him like a bunch of sheep.
Oh. Well, what year did you come to Fairbanks then?
Well,
that was
in 32.
32?
All of 32.
Now, you came here to go to the School of Mines?
Take the mining short course. Yeah.
The short course.
Yeah.
Well, with what intention? What was the reason
to be
a miner?
Then I was going to get rich mining.
Ah. Well, what had you heard about Fairbanks?
I knew there'd been a lot of mining going on here. You know, they talked about it around Juneau. I really got in 5 months in the Alaska Juneau mine working there. The timbermen. Uh-huh. And all the timber we used was just blocks to put in between them big steel beams they called grizzlies. Not as the bulldozers, they had to break up that rock to go in between them grizzlies. That reduced it down to the size where the mill could handle it. And that was a glory hole system, you know. They shot, load them powder, they drive a little tunnel, as small as they could, a powder tunnel, and then just fill it full of powder and blast it. And why they had the glory hole there was a mile across. And all of that snow and muck and dirt would go down into the mine. And the thing was so dirty that, you couldn't see anything. Them bulldozers get out there, and they had the bonus system. The more rock you broke, the more money you made, and they just kept cutting them down, so they're just breaking their necks trying to make an honest dollar or wages. And every once in a while, one of them get careless, and he'd fall in the chutes, and them chutes, some of them were 300-foot.
Ooh.
Deep and all up, you know, gravity feed. And well, they'd kill a man about every month or two. And I remember one time they missed a bulldozer, and well, one of the loading crew, they had a mine office, was going out to notify that they was missing a man. And them cars were 10-ton cars. They stood 7 foot high, you know. I walked by them a lot of times, and I know I had to look up. And he noticed steam raising off of this car, and he looks in an alley, that man that they'd drawn out of the chute and loaded him and never even seen him. But he just noticed that steam raising. I knew there's something warm down there. That's where that man was that they was missing. right on top of that car. They'd loaded him, send him out to the crushers.
Oh.
Yeah, that's...
Was Treadwell still working?
No, Treadwell was closed down. But Frank Kelb and I, an old-timer that's right here, living there, down here at, Sampson's Hardware, you know, that apartment they got there, he lives there now. He and I were batching together in Juneau, and we were taking a walk, and quite a wind blowing, a southeaster, and that Treadwell caught fire, and we stood over there on the in the lee of the storm and watched it burn up in about an hour. But that that whole setup was still there. The mills, you know, there was 200 stamps, and each mill had 10 stamps. You can imagine how many stamps there were, and a stamp complete supposed to weigh 1,000 pounds. And the Alaska Juneau mine bought that whole mess of iron and put up their own foundry, and they made all their cars and everything they needed in the mine. They cast it right there.
Gee whiz. We'll be back with Henry Brockman on Meet a Pioneer in just a moment after this from our sponsors, Sophie Station, Larson's Jewelers, Interior Signs, and Mount McKinley Mutual Savings Bank.
Meet a Pioneer is sponsored in part by Interior Signs, long established as one of the interior's most professional, most dependable year-round sign makers. They're licensed, insured, and always ready to serve Fairbanks with signs of every kind. Signs for business, contracting, or creative design. So for signs that stand the test of time, call Interior Signs at 479-3859. That's 479-3859. Interior Signs at 2405 South Cushman.
20 years ago, Mount McKinley Bank was founded by a group of forward-looking individuals who saw a need in the community. The new bank offered low-interest loans to encourage new home building in the Fairbanks area. It was an immediate success. Today, Mount McKinley Mutual Savings Bank is still located at 530 4th Avenue in the same building where founder Julian Rice and First President Judge Vernon Forbes served on the first Board of Trustees. The bank has seen a lot of history, and their solid background of investment and involvement in the community has earned Mount McKinley their own place in Fairbanks history. Mount McKinley Mutual Savings Bank is proud to sponsor Meet a Pioneer. At Mount McKinley, they're looking forward to a future as proud as their past.
When Roy Larson started Larson's Jewelers on that day back in 1946, he had big dreams of what he'd like his business to become. Over the years, some of those dreams changed and others came true. Today, Larson's is still a family-owned business and one of the finest and most complete jewelry stores in the interior. Almost 40 years of skill and experience go into everything they do. Like Fairbanks, they've grown, but they're still your friend and neighbor. Larson's, fine jeweler since 1946 at 405 Noble.
He's waiting for you.
We're back with Henry Brockman on Meet a Pioneer. Henry, I want to back up just a little bit about the Treadwell Mine. Now, I know the name, but I don't know a lot about it. Now, where was this mine?
It was on Douglas Island, just across from Juneau.
Okay. What sort of mine?
It was hard rock. And the mine, the gold was underneath, below sea level, you know.
Oh.
And they got so greedy, they mined, kept getting closer to the ocean, until finally it broke in on them.
How were they mining under the water? I can't picture this.
Well, there was no water. Well, of course, there was water in the mine, but they'd pumped that. But this seawater finally broke in on them, and that's what flooded the mine. They had to quit.
So they were mining off this island, and it was under the level, but off of the island is where they were working from.
It was below sea level, their gold was.
And they
mine.
Were digging up until finally
the
seawater caved in?
kept a-working up for them, and finally the ground wasn't strong enough to hold it anymore, and the sea just broke in on them. And well, that stopped the mine.
What happened to the miners?
Well, there was changing shift, I hear, and there was nobody in there.
No one in it at the time.
That's what they claimed.
That's a miracle. What year was this?
I don't know what year it was. I really don't.
Around the 30s, or?
No, it must have been before that.
20s, huh?
Yeah, because the Alaska Juno got going then, you know, and they bought all of that steel and all on Douglas Island and put up their foundry there.
Oh, I see, okay.
And made all their equipment right there.
Uh-huh.
Built their cars and everything.
Well, you came up to Fairbanks in 32 to take a short course and get rich in gold. Did you take the course at the college?
Oh, yeah.
How long did it last?
Oh, it was a couple of months, I think.
And who were your instructors or instructor?
Oh, there was Wilkerson, I remember, and Patty, Ernest Patty. He was the president then, I think. And I remember Wilkerson and Hugh Hinton was another one of our instructors. And let's see, who else? I've forgotten. But anyhow, I remember Wilkerson and Hinton. And of course, Burnell was the head man of the college them days.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I went and got a job cutting cordwood for the college. And up on them hills, I cut wood there. Well, 225 cords.
Gee.
They was burning coal and wood, you see, in them days.
I want to ask you a question about the weather. Obviously, this is a mild winter, and from what I understand, we're having a series of mild winters lately. And I've looked at our weather records from the National Weather Service in the 30s, about that time, 33, 34. There's some bitter weather, low temperatures set. Do you remember that?
I remember that because I was out on the homestead and working for Fairbanks Lumber. I worked for Fairbanks Lumber. I put in 27 years there.
Huh. So you remember it being definitely much colder. It really was colder then, huh?
Gosh, they was building Ladd Field out here. And I was checking lumber at 50 below zero, standing out there putting down a scratch every time the GI threw a board on a truck, you know. I never froze in all my life. I had a big parka and mucklucks, and I just walked, stomped from one foot to the other, rocking back and forth to keep from freezing. Mm. My goodness, what a job.
Well, after you took your short course in mining, then what did you do?
Then I tried mining myself, and then's when the depression hit. I'm just starved to death.
Where did you go? Where did you stake out?
On Happy Creek, Esther Dome, part of Esther Dome. If it hadn't been choking rabbits and shooting moose out of season, we would have stopped.
What kind of an operation did you have out there?
Well, it was placer mine.
Uh-huh.
And it was, odd as it may seem, but it was dry ground and wasn't wet. And most of that ground was so wet, you know, the old-timers, they couldn't afford to pump the water out. And there was no water. We were just damp ground, but there was no gold either. They called it Happy Creek. Like one of the boys that is out there says, it's got a beautiful name, but there's nothing to make us happy out here.
Well, how long did you persevere with this?
Two winters.
2 winters.
Take out a winter dump, you know, and then sluice it up in the spring when the water started running.
So it wasn't very productive then.
No, my first partner, he got enough of it the first year, and then I got a couple of boys from Esther. They decided they'd try it with me. So there's three hands around. But we had a lot of... Oh, it was fun, though. I remember an old fellow lived down at what they call Happy Station, old Doc Berg. And I went down to see him one evening, you know, in the winter time, bright moonlight. And I'd take the shotgun with me. Thought I might shoot a ptarmigan. And coming back to camp, there was rabbits hopping around every place, and I was shooting rabbits by moonlight with the shotgun. And I got three. And when I got up to camp, they said, "What in the heck were you doing shooting there in the dark?" I says, "It wasn't dark where I was. I shot rabbits, and now here's the rabbits. Look at them. I had three." But, you know, shooting a white rabbit on the snow is quite a trick. I'd watch them, and they'd hop, you know, and I'd just watch where he stopped, and I'd shoot where he stopped. And I got three out of four shot. That wasn't bad. We had enough rabbits anyhow for a day or two.
After living a lot,